and I'm talking with Rabbi Saul Solomon on Dave's Gone By on UNC Radio.
Oh, shalom, shalom. Good morning to you. Good Shabbos to everyone here on this fine Saturday. This is Rabbi Saul Solomon, the founder and spiritual leader of Temple Sons of Bitches in Great Neck, New York. And I am thrilled to hop over to the microphone on Dave's Gone By, H-O-P, I will say, because I'm going to be talking to the man who runs Hop Theatricals. This is a producing entity on Broadway. They've had productions or been involved in productions such as Oleana, the revival of that, that was on Broadway. American Idiot, the big Green Day show. They did the How to Succeed in Business Without Even Really Trying thing with Daniel Radcliffe, and they're working on more projects. The man's name, well, I call him Lev Ben Cohen, but the rest of the world will call him Larry K. Much more goyish sounding name. Please welcome to the neighborhood, Larry K. Welcome, Lev.
Thanks, Rabbi. I'm glad to be here.
Very glad to have you here in the station. And now, let me ask you right off the bat, like so many producers, not all, you began in a very different field, but one that you could say is related. You were a Jewish lawyer. Tell.
Not just a Jewish lawyer, a Jewish trial lawyer.
Oh, you got a trial. So how did you get into that?
Well, after I went to graduate school in theater for a period of time, and when I came back to the Washington, D.C. area, wasn't exactly sure what I was going to be doing sort of full-time, but I decided having an extra degree might be useful. I decided to go to law school, and when I went to law school, I enjoyed it a lot, thought it was interesting to be involved in the law, and decided to practice for a while.
Now, let me ask you a question here. You already had a graduate degree in theater. You had a master's in what? Theater, directing, acting? What were you doing?
Well, I didn't get a master's. I went to a program, ideally to get a master's in directing, but decided not to complete the program. It just wasn't a good fit for me. So I came back to the Washington area, decided to continue doing theater while figuring out what it is that I wanted to do at the age of, 22, 23.
And what was the time frame if you're starting all over and going into law? How many years did you have to do that and then pass the bar?
Well, I worked for a couple of years, and then I started back at law school when I was 26, and then was in law school for 4 years before I passed the bar.
Wow. So at age 30, you basically had this new life, and you were a trial attorney. Were you ambulance chasing? Were you doing, what kind of trials were you on?
Primarily employment law and civil rights litigation.
Ooh. So
representing employees. Typically who had been victims of discrimination or various other sort of wrongs that happened to them when they were in their workplaces.
What was the biggest case you fought and won?
Oh, gosh. I've had a number of cases against large corporations about sexual harassment or retaliation. I'd had a big case a few years ago against Xerox Corporation, which is certainly one of them. There were others, another one against the insurance company, Geico. And then recently, my last one was a lawsuit against a medical product design company. A client of mine who was a physician was injured using a particular device by this company to deliver treatments, and she suffered a pretty bad injury, which affected her ability to earn a livelihood. So that was a sort of a product liability case arising from an employment case.
Wow, and you must have felt, what is it like winning a case? Is it like getting a round of applause at the end of doing a show?
It is, it's a sort of a surreal experience. I've been through many trials, and always the moment, even if you feel like you put on a great trial, always the moment before the jury announces a verdict, you have this, at least I do, this moment where it crosses your mind that, you could lose, your client could lose everything, you could lose everything. And then, of course, the jury delivers the verdict. I've been fortunate.
Yes.
That in Maryland, where I practice, I've actually never lost a verdict.
Knock wood, halibi, toy, toy, toy. Okay.
It's still a sort of an ordeal. Putting on a trial is a real ordeal. It's all the preparation, and a lot of my trials go on for, weeks at a time. it's a really surreal experience when you see that process work and work out for your client. Victims of discrimination stuff, it's very empowering to them to be able to sort of get that redressed and sort of take back some of their power from employers who've really done a lot to make their lives difficult.
So do you think that the American justice system on the whole still functions? I mean, so many people think it's broken in a lot of ways. Do you still see it working?
You know, what I think is that it is broken in a lot of ways, and I've seen it be broken in a lot of ways. It is, at the moment, the best system that we have, and I think that the jury system, if done properly, ultimately finds the right resolution. But it's a question, really, you know, the lawyers have to do their jobs and get the right evidence in front of the jury. But jurors are very smart, you know, and they seem to work out the right answers often. It's just a question of giving them the right information.
Nicely put. And even though you're kind of, in some ways, hedging your answers, not in legalese, but in terms that you're careful about, I am wondering, and you don't have to mention names, what was the most heartbreaking trial that you did?
In Maryland, where I practiced, I've never lost a trial. So I sort of haven't suffered that level of heartbreak. In various trials I've won, we haven't necessarily won every claim, but in the trials that I've won in Maryland, it's always resulted in a favorable, you know, ultimately a favorable verdict for my client. But what I do think has been heartbreaking for me about the justice system is that people come to it with a very unrealistic view of what it will do for them. You know, I have clients who've won large verdicts who still don't have closure because an employer has never apologized to them, and they think somehow they're going to get the apology. Or clients who want to tell their story a certain way, but because of the rules of evidence, certain evidence gets excluded, and therefore they can't tell a complete story. And so they still don't have that closure, even if they win. And that's very disconcerting for a lot of clients, and it's the one thing that makes the justice system difficult. You know, we have all these rules that govern the way evidence works, and so I tell clients that a jury trial will not result in a story about the truth. It will result in a filtered truth, filtered by all these rules, but it can still result in the right. It can still end up with the right result.
If you want to tell the whole story, they've got to go write the book. And then try to sell that, put it on Kindle.
That's exactly right.
Well, we are telling the story at the moment of Larry K, a.k.a. Lev Ben Cohen, lawyer turned... Well, he was a theater person, then he turned to lawyer, then he turned back to the theater. How did you morph from... Or are you still a trial lawyer, by the way?
I am still a trial lawyer, but I've taken fewer and fewer cases. I'm slowly, you know... winding down my trial practice. I continue to consult with other attorneys and now do training for other attorneys on how to be better trial lawyers. But the full-time litigation practice is slowly coming to an end.
Well, gee, Larry K, what else is taking up your time? Wink, wink.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. It's always a deficiency in the amount of time that's available in a day.
Well, but how did you get back into the theater world?
Well, what I did was after I went to law school, I continued to be involved in theater in the Washington area, primarily as a director. And I was working at a theater, a small professional theater in the Washington area, a theater called Metro Stage.
Metro Stage, okay.
And I was working there, and they had a show that they were getting ready to help send to Off-Broadway that was being developed down there. It's a show I liked a lot. It was a two-person musical called Rooms.
Oh, yes, yes. Didn't that play at the Zipper Theater eventually with the funky couches and stuff?
No, it played at the...
When it made it to New York, I mean. I thought it played at the Zippers. I don't know. I'm misremembering. Continue. I'm sorry.
I think it was at New World Stages.
Oh, okay.
On Off-Broadway. And so they asked me if I would be interested in helping sort of produce it or support it. And I'd long thought that being a producer might be a really good use for my legal and theatrical skills, but didn't know a lot about what was involved. So I indicated I would be interested, but needed to know more. I met with the lead producer. We had a long discussion about it. I decided to support the show going to Off-Broadway. And then when I started to go to New York for meetings and various other interactions related to the show, I began to meet other producers and then started taking classes. There's a an organization called the Continuing,
The CTI?
Theater Institute, the CTI. And they offer classes to train new producers. So I took those classes, pretty much everything they had to offer, began to meet other producers, and then slowly began to get involved in other productions. And, you know, there's no substitution for on-the-job training, so I learned a lot more about what it was like to be a producer outside of the classes from being involved with shows.
Now, please explain for folks, because not everyone who listens to my radio program knows the ins and outs of theater, what would be the difference between a producer, say, and an investor?
Well, an investor may be someone who puts money into a show but hasn't necessarily put in at a sufficient level to have any sort of real participation, active week-to-week participation in the show. They're more of a passive investor. They put their money in and they wait for a return back. A producer could basically indicate someone who's either raised or put in money at a certain level, which then, as a result, involves them in other either decision-making about a show or participation in the day-to-day, week-to-week activities of the show, such as, you know, receiving reports about the how many ticket sales are being generated on a regular basis, planning advertising and marketing campaigns. And then beyond that, some producers are what we refer to as lead producers, and they typically have responsibility for the overall show. The lead producers or general partners, sometimes as we call them, are involved in, you know, hiring the director, finding the property that is going to be produced, overseeing the entire production and production staff, assisted by general managers, marketing and press people, advertising people. That's sort of the head of this little mini industry we call a Broadway show.
So let's take it almost show by show for some of the things that you have done on Broadway. One of the earlier things, even though it was just a couple of years ago, there was a revival of Blythe Spirit with Angela Lansbury. I remember her on a bicycle, in fact, toggling around as Madame Arcadi. So
yeah.
you were where on the food chain on that show?
So on the food chain, I there was an investor. That was actually my first Broadway show as an investor.
Okay, so you just, and they asked you for money, you gave money.
Moved up as a producer,
right,
to Oleana, How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying, American Idiot.
Well, let's go back to Oleana then. Fairly simple show to do. It's two characters, it's a desk, it's the professor's office. Shouldn't have been that expensive. You moved up the ladder. What decisions were you involved in on that Broadway production?
So, as a co-producer on that one, what I was involved in were meetings related to the ongoing marketing and advertising campaigns for the show.
Okay. And also, wasn't in that show, didn't the lead male actor, he leave after a few months? And then, was that the one with the sushi guy? Am I forgetting this?
No. That was Speed.
Oh, that was Speed the Plow. I'm sorry. I'm thinking, you're right. Forgive me. I'm getting so many things wrong this morning. It's a Shabbos.
All right. Oleana was with Bill Pullman and Julia Stiles.
Right, yes.
There was no sushi involved on that.
Good. Not, I do love sushi, well, the kosher stuff. But, so, good, so you were involved in that. And then after Oleana, as you said, came what, the How to Succeed?
No, American Idiot.
Oh, American Idiot after that. So, very different kind of show.
Yeah, absolutely. American Idiot was a really pretty spectacular musical based on the music of Green Day. And I became involved in American Idiot, in part because my dear friend Michael Mayer, who I actually had grown up with and went to elementary school and religious school with, was the director of the show, and wanted to, I followed Michael's career. He's a really fine director on Broadway and really wanted to support him in this. And so I began talking with the producers of American.
So what decisions can you point to that involving either the show or the marketing, the advertising, the budgeting, and say, oh, because I was there, this happened?
It doesn't quite work that way. In other words, what happens when you're a co-producer and not a lead producer is you're in a sort of a collective meeting where people are exchanging ideas. And that's what sort of happens on a regular basis with all shows. And so you would be discussing the ideas of, well, should we, you know, do this sort of marketing effort or that sort of marketing effort? And so I was part of that ongoing discussion as part of a group of people.
When you moved from that into the next show, did you move higher up there, or did you stay in that same kind of level of co-producing, you know, with...
Yes, I was still a co-producer again in How to Succeed in Business, one of a team of people, you know, sort of helming this pretty large musical. But there, the decision-making, the lead producers of that sort of conducted their meetings and decision-making in a little bit different way. And so there you really had some opportunity, I think, to have a greater effect. And so a couple of the marketing initiatives we did in How to Succeed in Business were ones that I'd suggested that then the group sort of adopted. And
such as?
I remember one in particular. You know, one of the difficulties when you produce a Broadway show, getting it up is already difficult, but maintaining it and continuing to be relevant and get audience members to remain active with it is sort of another matter. And I remember one of the ideas that I believe I was the one who suggested it was that throughout the year there'd be a way of, you know, electronically audience members or people who were hooked into our website to send greeting cards to each other, but using the characters and images from How to Succeed in Business.
Cute.
And so I remember some holiday greeting cards that we did, which quoted in a humorous way, like the song The Brotherhood of Man, which was one of our songs in How to Succeed in Business. And it might have been, as I recall, you know, an image of Daniel Radcliffe and some sort of saying about the brotherhood of man and wishing you a happy holidays or something like that. And people could send them electronically. And so that was sort of one, you know, particular initiative. And there were a lot of the marketing team on How to Succeed in Business was pretty brilliant in coming up with ideas to keep people involved.
And after Radcliffe was there for a period, and then did the Jonas brother come in? And you still had a...
Nick Jonas came in for a long period of time, but in between Daniel and Nick, we had Darren Criss come in, who was one of the cast members on that very popular television show, Glee.
Oh.
And Darren came in for a few weeks between Daniel and Nick.
So again, you have to meet and change the advertising and think of ways to get the word out and all that.
Exactly. Hi, this is Larry Kay, Broadway producer, and I'm talking with Rabbi Saul Solomon on Dave's Gone By on UNC Radio.
You have really been producing already into the internet, the Facebook, the Twitter age, because you're probably still recent and relevant to all this. I mean, where's the budget going? How do you proportion it? What still goes to, like, the New York Times and local radio and TV stations as opposed to website marketing, these ideas about greeting cards, etc.?
It really varies on a sort of a show-by-show basis. The actual budgets and the way you develop them is truly based on the needs of the show. If you have a show that decides that they want to do a much larger upfront advertising campaign before they open, you know, you're going to structure the budget one way. Some shows do a minimal advertising budget until they open because they think that they're going to need the reviews first before they can really get people to, you know, buy their tickets. So, and then in terms of the way you would spend your budget, there's some shows that would advertise do better on television or radio than in print, for instance. And so that's going to sort of determine a little bit about the way you would do the budget. And that's all planned out by the advertising and marketing people with the lead producers.
That makes sense. Well, what would be an example of something that you might have done differently in some of the shows that you've been on? Because How to Succeed was, as I recall, a hit. People really enjoyed it. The critics loved it. Oleana, not so much, or critics liked it, but audiences didn't really come for it.
Yeah. Well, I think there's a bunch of things. I think one of them is that you have to ultimately have a show. In order to succeed, in every instance, you've got to have a show that people want to leave the theater and immediately recommend to other people. If someone doesn't recommend your show, it doesn't mean they didn't like it. But for some reason, they didn't like it enough or it didn't resonate with them enough to recommend it.
Fair enough.
And so when you have a show that lets people leave feeling either entertained or incredibly moved or incredibly resonated with, oftentimes that will translate into good word of mouth. Oleana is a difficult show because the show is a sort of a take on a sexual harassment, if you will, allegation where you're not really supposed to know who's right and who's wrong, you know, ends with a pretty difficult physical fight between the two characters. And both of them have really been significantly destroyed by the time the show is over. It does not make for certainly a fun evening of theater, even if it might be enlightening, and oftentimes is not the kind of show that people want to rush out and then turn and recommend. And so I think that's the difficulty with, you know, sort of Oleana. We face, you know, you face challenges in every show. In American Idiot, I think our challenge was getting people to buy tickets for a show about the music of Green Day when Green Day wasn't necessarily in the show. Although we did, for a period of time, have Billy Joe Armstrong from Green Day in the show, and then the ticket sales sort of reflected that.
And I think also your thing of marketing the American Idiot musical is simply telling anyone over 35 who the hell Green Day was, and 35 plus is still, on some level, the Broadway audience. So you had that too.
It is, but I think you have to figure out, you know, how to reach them, and what's your show about? I mean, is it a rock show? Is it a rock opera? Is it a musical? I think, you know, we had some, I think, difficulty defining exactly what the show was. And the other, I think, difficulty we had with American Idiot, I think, was probably in a theater that was a little too large. And because when you're in a larger theater, it costs you more money. The show had a very large scale to it, but I'm not sure ultimately, in reflecting back, that we wouldn't have run longer if we hadn't been in a slightly smaller theater. I just don't know. You know, it's one of those things you don't always know. I think one of the challenges we discovered in How to Succeed in Business when we did our switchover from Daniel to Darren and then Darren to Nick was the very quick rebranding of the show posed challenges for us from an advertising and marketing perspective, which I think we managed fairly well, but it's difficult, you know, to advertise and promote Darren Criss if 3 weeks later Nick Jonas is coming in.
Huh.
And then you have to turn everything around. And we made a decision in How to Succeed in Business to rebrand the show each time. We had sort of an iconic image, which we retained generally with some changes in color of the image. You know, Daniel had a blue bow tie and Nick had a green one and had a purple one. We've made their backgrounds accordingly, but kept the sort of iconic general image. But it's difficult to rebrand a show that quickly and still keep the marketing efforts up. So.
And then there's that unknown factor that is theater. For example, where you take a show like The Producers, which everybody thought would run for 30 years before you could even get another ticket, and that closed after just a few years. It couldn't survive the post Nathan Lane, Matthew Broderick thing. Whereas you have a show like Chicago, which had B.B. Newworth and Anne Reinking and Joel Grey, or Wicked, which also had Joel Grey and then Chenoweth and Menzel, and yet those casts departed, and those shows have become juggernauts. They may run forever.
One of the differences is The Producers, by virtue of the marketing, was so completely associated with Nathan and Matthew that when they tried to rebrand it, it made it more difficult. And they weren't rebranding it with people at the same sort of level of being known as Nathan and Matthew were. And so it's a challenge. Wicked, they bring people in and out of Wicked all the time, changing the roles of the women who play the, you know, the witches. But the emphasis is not on the particular people playing the particular role. The emphasis is on the Wicked brand itself.
Right.
And that's certainly one reason why they don't have to contend with it. The brand itself is bigger, typically, than any star they would have in it.
By the way, we're talking with Larry Kay, who is a Broadway producer, as well as a nice Jewish boy and lawyer. But let me ask, take us to that point when a show is just hovering at, like, the red line. It's been running a bit. You're thinking of all these different ideas. At what point do the producers all turn to each other and say, we got to give it 2 weeks, or it's got to end on January 5th? Well, how does that decision get made?
Well, lots of things go into it. You know, the producers are kept continuously aware about the level of reserves they have to cover any losses, because all shows typically suffer losses at various points in their run. There are weeks in the year-long, you know, performance schedule which are known to be weeks where less people go to the theater, and therefore shows sometimes will take small losses. The producers are aware of the reserves and are aware of what those weeks are and the downtimes. The producers are getting ongoing what we call wrap reports, reports of ticket sales that are wrapping, was the word we use. And we get reports on those for periods of times, you know, months in advance. And so the producers can see if the sales are trending upward or trending downward. And if the sales are trending downward, you know, and we're coming up on bad weeks, typically, for instance, the start of January can be difficult, or the month of February sometimes can be very difficult, and the reserves are lower, the producers know that it's unlikely, based on experience, that there's going to be a sudden turnaround and people will start, you know, flocking to the theater to buy tickets for that show. It may be wiser to close the show and return what's, you know, part of the remaining reserves to the investors, along with whatever money that the investors may have gotten, you know, up to that point.
So if a show closes and does not hit the black, it is not technically what they call a hit. A hit means that it will have made at least a dollar in profit. But it doesn't mean every time that all the investors and all the producers lose everything. If it runs a while, you know, and on some weeks makes some money, they don't close completely and, you know, losing everything. Is that true?
Right. And most shows that close do not lose everything. Most shows do repay something. But the other thing that's important to know is a lot of shows will go on sort of beyond the actual Broadway production to have an afterlife, which will again bring additional money into the Broadway company. Because in the case of, for instance, new musicals or new plays, typically when those are produced, the people who invest or produce the Broadway company will have ongoing interest in anything related to that show moving forward, because all those forward items, tours or licensing or perhaps a film, will all in some way generate revenue for the Broadway company. And once the show's closed on Broadway and all its bills have been paid, all of those additional revenue streams generate money that flows down to the producers and investors in various ways.
For example, I think in terms of like a show that opened this year on Broadway called First Date. Cute little show, not fantastic, not terrible, but very funny, nice little musical that people wonder, well, why did they bring this to Broadway? It's nice, it would have been good at an off-Broadway house. But now, you know that show is going to be done. Every community theater, high schools are going to do First Date. It's just going to be everywhere. And so if it closes, it will in January as a quote-unquote flop. One figures the ancillary life of that show is the reason. Now everybody can say, ooh, we want to do First Date because it played on Broadway and it's cute. Am I sort of right on that?
And that's right, because there's a certain level of, I don't know what the word is, cachet, I suppose, that comes with having sort of been on Broadway. And you're absolutely right. Some shows will do better in touring companies or in the regional theaters around the country than they will in a Broadway theater where they're really up against a variety of shows and have to cut through a lot of what we call noise generated by other shows in order to really draw people in to see them. And yeah, absolutely. I mean, Legally Blonde is a good example of a show that it didn't do that well here in New York. You know, financially, it was a very cute show. A lot of people really enjoyed it. But on the road, it's, you know, people seem to really love it.
The Wedding Singer also, quite enjoyable show, but it flopped on Broadway, and then boom, it's everywhere.
Right, that's exactly right.
Let me ask about the show that you had wanted to get up on Broadway, I guess it was last season, called The Velocity of Autumn, a show that you are working on. It played in Washington at Arena Stage. You had Estelle Parsons in it, and the reviews were good. So, why didn't it make the leap yet?
Well, we're waiting for a theater. Basically, last spring we were hoping to come in, but there was no theater available for us that was suitable size. We were offered a theater that was much larger than the one we needed. It's the Velocity of Autumn is a two-character play, and so we wanted to be in the right theater. One of the quickest ways to kill a show is to take a theater that's too large, that will kill the intimacy of the show, or, you know, create expenses for you that, you know, are going to be more difficult to meet. So we decided to wait, and we were able, fortunately, to move very quickly to get The Velocity of Autumn into the schedule for the first play of the season at the Arena Stage in Washington, which, as you know, is one of the country's preeminent regional theaters.
Yes.
So we did the play down there. It gave us a chance to work on the play with the actors and the playwright. You're right, the show was received, you know, got very strong reviews. We invited New York critics to come and review it. Got a very nice review from The Times, a wonderful review from Variety, and a lot of other terrific reviews. And now we're ready, again, to come back to New York, and we're essentially in a waiting mode, just waiting to hear from the theater owners about what theater might be available for us.
Well, do you feel like a vulture sometimes? Because do you look at the grosses of other shows in the smaller theaters, like The Booth or, you know, the Helen Hayes or something like that, and go, they don't seem to be doing so hot. Let me call the theater owner then. Let me call the Schuberts.
You know, it's funny because sort of the unwritten rule of as you talk to the theater owners, you never sort of talk about specific shows they have in specific theaters until they're ready to discuss it, because it's just bad form. You know, they have shows, they're all hoping the shows that are all in their current theaters will run very well.
Sure.
But everybody also knows that as you assess the landscape and what's out there, you've got to engage in a certain amount of speculation about who might be coming in or which shows might be closing. And, you know, the numbers that the shows are making on a weekly basis are published every Monday by the Broadway League. And so you can see the grosses, the gross ticket sales by the various shows, by theater, and you'll have a sense of where shows are, whether they're, you know, rising up to their potential or whether they're falling short. So it is something that producers do engage in.
And it's almost like a jigsaw. It's more complicated than a jigsaw puzzle, because now let's say you have this project, Velocity of Autumn. So it was ready last year, couldn't find the theater. It's ready this year. Maybe you'll find the theater, hopefully, maybe not. And then, you know, you have to figure, well, will Estelle Parsons take a film role? You can't just hold on to her. You know, she has other things to do. So it's all this kind of has to be the right moment to strike or projects go cold.
It's always about how many moving pieces there are. And that's why producers often work on a number of projects, and then when something is ready, it will sort of bubble up to the surface and go. And when your projects are ready to go, you better be ready to go, because, you know, it's like the perfect storm. You don't always have all the factors coming in together all at once.
Well, what other projects do you have in ready or go mode?
Well, The Velocity of Autumn is sort of on the very front burner. The other projects are in a position right now where they're a little bit not formed well enough to be sort of talking about them, but I'm working on several potential new musicals and a couple of potential new plays and one revival of a play.
Wow. Well,
they're all sort of being worked on,
yeah,
cast, discussed, pitched to directors or performers right now.
Are you the lead producer on all those projects?
I am.
Wow. What about things where I'm sure other producers and producing groups still approach you to get involved in other shows. Are any of those bubbling?
Yes. I mean, I have one. I'm going to have a meeting actually later on today about being involved with a new musical next year, which I've seen, you know, sort of in several different versions and readings and workshops. That show has not been officially announced yet, but it's very exciting. If it happens, it'll be very exciting and will be a wonderful family musical. So that's really interesting to me. And I've been largely focusing on my own projects because it's the way that I can be the most certain that they'll move at a time and pace when it feels right for me.
Now, Larry K., do you see most or all of the shows in a given Broadway season, or do you just watch the grosses?
No, I try to see everything in the season.
Let's do a little bit of a quizzy sort of a thing here. And I'd be curious to know your thoughts on the shows as well as the way they're perhaps being marketed, or whether, had you been approached, you would have put money or time or effort into them, and whether you would have regretted that. So let's say we just heard recently that the musical Big Fish is going to be closing at the end of the year. Big Fish, directed and choreographed by Susan Stroman, featuring Norbert Leo Butz, supposed to be the big extravaganza musical for the fall season on Broadway. Critics go, eh. Audiences like it, but I guess they're not coming out of the theater, as you say, saying you must see this, da-da-da. Boom. Were you approached for Big Fish? If you had, would you have jumped?
You know, it's hard to say what you would have done. I was not approached for Big Fish. You know, I think it was a great subject for a musical. The difficulty is that the material is so rich that figuring out how to edit it into a good narrative for the stage is very challenging. I think there's a lot of really brilliant things in Big Fish and really wonderful performances, and I'm very sorry that it's not going to have a longer life on Broadway. I think the difficulty that they faced with the critics had mostly to do about the narrative structure of the show, and that is just a really difficult challenge. But I think the performances were wonderful, and there were so many things in it that are really magical, and I would, you know, encourage people, if they could, to see it before it leaves.
I have to say, my good friend Dave, who hosts this radio program, he liked it quite a bit, too, and was sorry to see that it's not going to last very long on Broadway. What about, let's say, when they announced the Romeo and Juliet that they have on Broadway? There's so many Shakespeare's on Broadway this particular season, after sort of a dry spell. So now you've got Orlando Bloom, movie star, Condola Rashad, theater star, boom, would you have invested, and what do you think of how they're doing, especially since the critics were not happy with the production?
You know, I of course, I love Romeo and Juliet, and Condola Rashad, I love Orlando Bloom as a film actor, and Condola Rashad is just a brilliant, brilliant actress, and she was just in the production of The Trip to Bountiful that I was involved in. I think the difficulty with Shakespeare is that, you know, a lot of it has to do with the approach. I think one of the critics really didn't seem to enjoy about this particular Shakespeare performance had a lot to do with the director's approach. It's hard to tell, again, you know, whether, you know, if you were approached and you sort of had all this information, you would have invested a lot of time. You can't know how everything's going to turn out. I think that a large Shakespeare production is difficult to do commercially on Broadway because of the cast size, therefore the expense size, as well as dealing with this issue of the approach and what particular take on it are you going to get.
Well, so, by contrast, you have the
more challenging.
You have the Mark Rylance and Stephen Fry, the double bill that's being done of Twelfth Night and Richard III, where the critics just fell all over themselves raving, and I assume that's going to be a big audience hit. Did you have that feeling?
It feels like it's going to be big. I was not approached about being involved in that show, but I haven't seen it yet either. I'm very excited to. Mark Rylance is just a brilliant, brilliant actor, and the all-male idea of doing these two Shakespeare's in repertory with an all-male cast is wonderful. Of course, that's the way they used to be performed in,
right,
in the old Globe times, but I'm really excited to see it.
The other side of the coin, something that nobody really paid much attention to or expected, and then Jack Viertel comes in with After Midnight. This little review of the Cotton Club years kind of flies in under the radar, and boom, it looks like it'll be one of the sleeper hits of the season.
I know, and what a great thing that was. You're absolutely right. There was a good example of an instance where there was not a massive advertising budget used to tell people about the show first, but now they are really capitalizing on the spectacular reviews. And again, I was going to see it as I typically would everything. But now I really can't wait to see it. And it's a lot different a show in terms of the way it's been structured than what I anticipated it would be. And so I think it's great. And I think their idea of having these guest performers come in this musical review to do several songs. Right now it's Fantasia of Reno, but it's going to be other people. I think Katie Lang is coming in and others. I think it's just genius, and I'm really thrilled that it's doing so well.
We're talking with Larry Kay. Just a couple more questions, because this is so much fun talking about the current Broadway season and things. But I have to ask, since you are a producing entity, if you hear about readings and backers auditions and things coming down the pike, but let's say, you know, they don't have you on the radar, or they're not invited per se, can't you just call people and wave money at them if you're excited about a project and say, let me in?
You don't even have to wave money. In most instances, if you're a producer and you hear of a reading coming down and you'd like to attend, you can find out, you know, sort of who's in charge of the production or what general management firm is involved with it. You can call them and indicate that you'd like to come and see the reading. And generally, you know, they'll be very happy to have you attend. It's very rare that you know, a production is so closed that they're not even interested in having other producers attend. Sometimes it happens, but it doesn't happen very frequently.
I was just curious, because I figure if you're excited about any project or reading that you see, they'll be happy to take your money.
Well, you know, part of what being a producer is, yeah, there's always someone who's willing to take your money, that's for sure, but part of what being a producer is to sort of stay on top of what's out there. And, you know, finding the opportunities for yourself and your investors, you know, there I've been to projects before where, you know that if you don't act quickly, you know, someone else will be interested in the show, and so you have to act quickly and make your you know, very high level of interest known to the lead producers. This hasn't happened to me quite as much lately because I've been focusing largely on my own production, but in terms of the family musical that I mentioned earlier, I can't really sort of talk about the title of it, but, you know, I went to a recent sort of reading/workshop of it and thought it was really terrific, and obviously it's got a ways to go. It's still in development, but it was clear that the material was very solid. The narrative was very solid. It would really be appealing to people. I was personally very moved by it. It's a well-known title, and for all of those reasons, you know, as soon as the reading was over, I told the producers that I'd be interested in involved in it with it in a large degree, and that's what we're going to be having a meeting about today. But anyway, you have to make that interest known.
Now let me ask finally for Larry Kay, the producer, about a couple of shows. I'm going to have you take the crystal ball out, and let's talk about some shows that are due for the spring. How you think they'll do, if you think they're being marketed properly already, or perhaps not yet, or if you wish you had money in them, or you wouldn't touch them with a 10-foot pole. So, for example, the musical coming up, Bridges of Madison County.
You know, I didn't get a chance to see it when it was up at Williamstown. It sounds like just a beautiful show, and I'm really looking forward to it. And I hope all the shows that are on Broadway in the spring do well, but I'm very excited to see that one.
And what about Rocky?
Also, Rocky, I mean, you know, Mamma Mia has now moved out of the Winter Garden Theater, and Rocky's in, and I understand it's a pretty fantastic-looking production. I have not heard any of the music. I have some people that I know who are working on it, and, you know, it should be quite an event in the Winter Garden.
And what about the Woody Allen-based Bullets Over Broadway?
Well, I have to tell you, this is one of the shows that I'm the most excited about. I've always loved that movie Bullets Over Broadway. I've known that, you know, a musical has been in the works for a very long time, and it's really great to see it coming in. And I think that Susan Stroman, the sort of the era and the types of the style of the dance numbers and things like that that you would see in a show like for Bullets Over Broadway is right up her alley. I think Woody Allen's just a brilliant writer, and it's one of the shows really that I'm the most excited about seeing.
But again, it's not like you went to the producers and said, I want to be involved. You're just excited about, like any audience member would be.
Right, and I actually was asked to be involved in Bullets Over Broadway, and the only reason I decided not to is because I have to have my sort of singular razor focus on Velocity of Autumn and the couple of projects that are being developed in the very, very short term. If you split your focus too much and try to raise money for too many things while work on others, it can really be detrimental. And so that's the only reason that I decided not to become involved in Bullets Over Broadway.
Well, wait a minute.
Because I think it's going to be a great show and a great big hit.
When you say that your focus has to be on Velocity of Autumn, what do you have to do day-to-day on that show if there's not a theater yet?
Well, we're still completing our money raising. We're at the very sort of tail end of that. So that's been going very well. We've had a huge amount of interest generated and are talking with and sort of signing deals with, additional producers all the time. But we're putting in place an advertising and marketing campaign so that when we do get the go-ahead for the theater, we can move very quickly.
Can I ask what the capitalization would be on a small show like that?
Well, we don't ever really get into, it's hard for us to sort of get into numbers publicly. Fortunately, because it's a small show with two characters and a single, unit set, it makes it very affordable to produce and therefore, as a result, pretty attractive to potential producers.
Can you do maybe percentages then of how much for a show like that is the set, how much is the actors, unions, all that, how much is advertising, and how much is like other stuff or royalties or rights? What's the pie wheel?
It's hard to, I would say that about, it's hard to do without all the budgets in front of me, but I would say that your biggest sort of upfront expenses in new plays involve advertising and marketing, as well as if you're engaging in smart producing, a substantial amount of reserve that you're going to put aside to let the play really have a chance to take off and build word of mouth and devote time to that. Everything else is sort of spread out fairly evenly between the physical production, fees for directors and designers. It's hard to sort of pin it down on a slice of pie basis.
That's fair. And last question for Larry Kay, because we do hope that Velocity of Autumn will come to Broadway, if not in the spring, then certainly by summer or autumn. But when you say you've got to give it time, you've got to let the audiences come find it, you've got to advertise it and push it, how long would you say, you've got previews, how long would you let a show be open and losing money perhaps week to week before you expect to see the ramp up, before it starts to even approach the black and you say, oh, okay, this can run for a bit?
It depends. It's the thing is that if you've got the money in the reserves and you are marketing the show the right way and you're seeing upward trending in terms of how the ticket sales are going, then that may be a good sign. We're always measuring the sales that we see and the results that we see against other things that we know. So if we, for instance, see ticket sales, trending downward and we're coming up on January, February months, we may have some difficulty. On the other hand, if each day we're wrapping more and more ticket sales compared to the prior days or the prior weeks of the same day, or if we have a piece that goes out, or an interview, let's say, that an actor does about a show that results in a much bigger wrap and a steadier, bigger wrap, then those are good sort of projections. And so it's always a question of sort of keeping as much oversight of all the different pieces of the puzzle, if you will, to determine how a show is doing. And if you have good people working with you, good general management, advertising, marketing, press people, you know, they're also your eyes and ears about what's going on. And what you really want are people who are going to give you, you know, not only the good news, but also the bad news. You want to be as informed a decision-making ability as you can.
Well, you have given us such clear and concise and good information over what it means to be a producer on Broadway. It's been absolutely delightful and incredibly informative talking to Larry K, or I'll call him Lev, which means heart. You have my heart, Mr. K, you do indeed, in a nice financial way. I'm married with 21 and a half children. It's a very different sort of a thing. But I want to thank you.
My Broadway shows are my dependents.
Yeah. Oh, are you married? Do you have kids? Anything like that?
No.
See, so
I'm
that's...
married, no kids.
I've got the Torah, and I do my little interviews, and that's my life, so there you go. Anywho, it's been absolutely delightful talking with Larry K in the neighborhood. Best of success with your upcoming shows. May they be many, and may they make tons and tons of money, and, more importantly, make people happy.
Great. Thank you, Rabbi, very much. It was delightful to talk to you.
You too. Shalom.
Shalom to you, too.